So golf's difficult, and I always say that golf's a really difficult sport, but it teaches us so much about life, doesn't it? How things aren't always going to be easy, but actually we work hard at something, we can find the answer, and it might just, might, golf gives us a glimmer of hope. How many times do we play the last hole well if we've had a bad round? It's just dangling the carrot, telling you to come back and give it another go.
Welcome to Golf Yourself Healthy, the podcast which invites guests from all corners of the golf, health and well-being industry to share inspiring stories and practical insights on how we can be at our best mentally, physically and socially, both on and off the golf course. I'm Chris Lynch, your host and the founder of GYH, where it is our mission to help you live happier, healthier and more fulfilled lives through the power of golf. If that sounds like a movement and a community that you would like to be a part of, then head to golfyourselfhealthy.com and subscribe now. Today's guest, James Whatley, is a shining example of what it means to use golf for good. James is not only a highly experienced and personable golf coach, but he's also a highly accomplished player as well, having previously represented his country in the PGA Cup, and also having played on the DP World Tour at the BMW PGA Championship at Wentworth back in 2013. In this conversation, James reveals how one of the things he loves and cherishes most in his role as a PGA coach is to help people to get maximum enjoyment from golf and to fulfill their potential. Most poignantly, James is a passionate advocate for mental health and breast cancer awareness. Following the passing of his sister Janine back in 2018, after a long battle with breast cancer, James has chosen to keep her memory alive and to help others through hosting various golf charity days and championing other initiatives to raise money and awareness for these important causes. James sets a wonderful example for his coaching peers and the wider golf community, and as ever, this is a conversation which is both insightful and inspiring in equal measure. Without any further ado, let's tee off and jump into the conversation. James Whatley, welcome to the Golf Yourself Healthy podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you to Kedleston Park, right, for hosting us. That's where we are here today on a gorgeous day. I did consider wearing my sort of long sleeve, mid-layer GYH branded top today, but I thought I'd be sweating buckets if I did that, so I chose not to, but we're at a nice place where you coach here on Fridays, right?
I do, yes. Yeah, one day a week coach here. I'm head pro at Morley Hayes Golf Club, but also a member here at Kedleston Park, along with my wife and children. So yeah, it's a lovely setting to be a member as well.
Nice. Given your level of golf, you must be pushing the course record here. What is the course record here, out of interest?
I think it's maybe 63, 9 under.
You had a go at that before?
I've had 65 in a pro event round here.
Lovely.
So yeah,
tell my listeners a little bit about who you are, a bit about your background, what you do.
I'm a PGA golf professional. Like I say, I've been head professional at Morley Hayes. I've been there since 2004. I started playing golf when I was 10 or 11, and I got into golf through my mum had some lessons bought for her for Christmas from my dad. She had three of the six, and just time and frustration, I think, got the better of her. And I had the next three lessons, and kind of, as they say, the golf bug bit me and kind of got into that, really. And it left school at 16 I was going to be a golf pro. That was it. I was taken off. You've heard probably stories like this before. I was taken off to the career advisor down the road, and they said, basically, you've got no chance and stuff. Like, people that know me, when someone tells me I can't do something, that's just like, yeah, red rag to a bull kind of thing. And it was like, well, I'll prove you wrong. And I turned pro 3 years later and played professionally ever since then. But I did my PGA training straight away. That was one of the sort of remits from my parents, was like, just to go and do your PGA training, get the qualification. And hooked on coaching. I've like loved the golf swing, loved studying the golf swing. I was inspired by probably someone like David Ledbetter. Nick Faudo was my inspiration to get into it. And ever since then, I've taught and I created a business in 2007, East Midlands Golf Academy, just on my own, and that's based at Morley Hayes. And we got up to 7 pros a couple of years ago. We're down at 5 at the minute, but we've grown golf since then with juniors, beginners, ladies getting to golf, all the way through from grassroots, all the way through to sort of professional level as well.
Yeah.
And I still love competing. I've been very lucky to achieve some good things within the sort of the PGA tournament schedule over the years. Represented the PGA in the PGA Cup, which is the Club Pros Ryder Cup, against America. So I went off to America. That was back in 2007. Represented England as well at the PGA level. So yeah, no, I've had golf's given me a lot over the years, and it's given me a lot of friendships and. Right from being a 10-year-old, really. So yeah, no, very lucky.
Yeah, I noticed that. Was it this year that you were at final qualifying for the Open Burnham and Barrow?
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. First tee shot.
I did. Yeah, 6:20 in the morning. So yeah, that was, and it was something like I'd been going to Open qualifying since 2002, and it was my 9th appearance at final qualifying, and I probably loved it the most.
This one?
Yeah, I don't know what it was about. Maybe everything about it. The weather was great, hitting the first tee shot. I played with a local lad as well, so we had a crowd. And I think I just had sort of real appreciation for how lucky I was to be at final qualifying for the Open, 36 holes away from playing in arguably the greatest championship in the world. And there's me giving it a go, really. So yeah, no, very, very lucky to have those experiences.
Last year was the first time I really dialed into the importance or significance of final qualifying for the Open, because you had people like Justin Rose qualifying out at Burnham and Barrow last year. So have you, given the number of years you've been doing it, have you almost seen how, because I listened to quite a few golf podcasts, and a few of them were saying how the number of spectators now that even go to watch a final qualifying, because you've got some of these big names coming along. So it must have been what made it such a special one?
Yeah, I think the people that are there, it is final qualifying is an unbelievable thing. And I think it's in the social media definitely helps. Going back to final qualifying, the first year I was there, which was 2003, it was at Prince's Golf Club that backs onto Royal St George's.
Yeah.
Quick story that I was teeing off in final qualifying in the old days, I sound old, but back then, over 20 years ago, was on the Sunday, Monday. The Open started on the Thursday.
Right.
So this would be on the Monday, and I'm teeing off on the 6th hole, I think, at Prince's, and the 14th hole at Royal St George's kind of runs behind it. And there must be 3,000 people on the 14th hole, the par 5 at St George's, and this Tiger Woods and Adam Scott playing a practice round together as I'm teeing off. And they all stopped for me to hit my tee shot down the 6th hole at Prince's. And I'm like, wow, what an experience that is. And that was always pretty cool when the final qualifying was so close to the Open. You got a pass into the Open. Even if you didn't qualify, you could just go and... You're almost classed as one of the players at when you were at final qualifying. So they've changed it now for the logistics to be like 3 weeks before.
Nice.
But it's a pretty cool experience.
So they knew the etiquette to stop, or did you have to be like, lads, do you mind just pipe down a bit?
So yeah, no, yeah. Everyone stopped, which, as I say, yeah, that always sticks in my mind.
That's brilliant. What do you enjoy most about the job that you do? I know before we went on air, you were telling me how actually, you know, in preparation for this conversation, we're talking about how golf is good for you. You were saying actually as a pro, it can be quite a stressful thing.
I think it's like helping people. Like there's nothing better than on a weekend, on a Sunday night, getting a message from someone saying, I've had 42 points and I've won the competition, or I've had my best round of the year. That tip really helped me. So it's just helping people. There's nothing better than in the world, whatever it is, whatever job you do, if you can have an positive influence on somebody. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you've got for me when I go into work. What positive influence can I have on that person on that given day? And that can sometimes just be listening. It can sometimes be working on their golf swing. They'll come in with like 10 things they're working on that they may have watched on YouTube or Instagram. And my job is just to try and declutter their brain a little bit. So yeah, I think it's helping people. I think that's what I love about my job. And you have to, like any job, you have to sometimes rip it back and go, what am I doing this for? Because any job can get stale at times. And I think you've just got, oh, if you're helping people, that's my inspiration.
Yeah. Did I hear you right that I suppose when you decided at teenage years or whatever that you wanted to become a golf pro, the focus then was probably on my performance, my playing, but then in time that kind of, have you always been the sort of person that's wanted to help others, or is that naturally a value or a skill you've developed as you got into the more teaching side?
I think I'd like to class myself as a caring person, and I want to make sure everyone's okay. So I think that pushes over into your coaching as well. Yeah. And there is a fine line between your own playing and that drive to be better.
Yeah.
And the coaching. So yeah, it's always learning. I'm just like constantly always learning and try and reflect on. So sometimes I'll work on something with a player and I'll go, oh, I could do that in my own game. And I'm constantly tinkering. And I probably do myself more harm than good sometimes when I'm tinkering with my golf game, but I just love it. I love trying to, so every Thursday, normally every Thursday, sometimes Friday, but I try and do it to every Thursday, that I'll put a tip out there, no more than 2 minutes of something that I feel they could take to the golf course that weekend. Something real, one thought. And so I put out a message this morning regarding coming on this podcast, and I asked them the question of, what does golf bring them really, what it's given them? And the biggest thing I would say, it's given them friendships. And I think that's really, it's given them friendships, it's helped with their mental health to get away from their stresses of everyday life. It's sort of a sanctuary, that was a word that was used, a sanctuary away from the everyday. We know life can, on a hamster wheel and getting on the golf course, exercise was another one. One comment from somebody said, it actually has made me do Pilates, it's made me stretch. So my health, my well-being just in life is better from playing golf. Because for him to play golf well, he actually needed to do Pilates, yoga, stretching, to be able to play golf better. So his overall health was better as well, which was an interesting one as well. And I think connections, I think that's what golf's given a lot of people from what they've sent me. It's connections, being able to play with, meeting new people, going all around the world. So one thing I do golf holidays 3 or 4 a year. So they travel the world, they meet new people.
Mm-hmm.
Golf gives people so much, really. Playing with family members. I mean, I'm very lucky I get to play with my kids, my wife. Different generations. Golf allows that, doesn't it? With handicaps, you haven't all got to be scratch golfers to play. You can have a laugh with your friends, and someone could be off 5 handicaps, someone could be off 25, and it doesn't matter.
Could I ask you briefly on handicaps, right? There's this thing that, almost a theme that's been, I'm going to do a podcast on it at some stage, but almost whether, I think the episode strapline or title, working title is, are handicaps healthy or a hindrance? Because I see how I believe that having a handicap is, I think it's beneficial because you've got, I'm kind of a numbers guy. I like to strive for something and know how I'm getting on. But, and I don't know if you're seeing this, the newer generation of golfer that's coming through, like for example, there's a couple of lads that I've just started playing golf with who I've met through NCT classes, having my daughter. I had them out playing the other night, and they've got no interest in having a handicap whatsoever. They're quite happy, go out, play 9 holes, go for a curry afterwards, and that's the extent of their... So are you... I mean, what's your take on that?
I think there's a place for... I think a handicap's a great thing because it's a leveler, isn't it?
Yeah.
But I also appreciate people that don't want to have keep score. They just want to go out and play.
Yeah.
So I think a handicap allows... That to be competitive, I am a competitive person.
Yeah.
But that means I can go out with one of my mates who's off 18 and have a game. And he can say, I'll beat a pro today.
Yeah.
If he beats me.
Exactly.
Which is amazing, isn't it? I mean, it all depends what you want to get out of it. So they are healthy.
But that comes back to like why people play golf. And actually one of the reasons I love golf so much is because there are so many different ways that you can consume golf, play golf, enjoy it, and everyone's motivations are different. Your guy who's the Pilates guy, so you were asking me before we went on air, other episodes we've got lined up. So we've got Linda Segerstam, who's a Pilates instructor for golf, coming on soon. So need to put him onto that episode because he'll be quite intrigued to listen to it, I'm sure. On the flip side of this, so you've got golf is good for you. You've given a few examples of what your clients have been saying, what they love about golf and how they've enjoyed it. Sounded like a couple of them said it's frustrating as well, or it's hard. So the question I was going to put to you is, you know, golf is hard, but at least my belief is doing hard things is actually good for you. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, no, definitely. Because people come into me for lessons and they're almost beaten by golf. That's what you, so it's, there's not, you've got to remember, people come in for a lesson, I'll say, how's the golf going? And there's like this deflation. Not many people come in and go, it's feeling, it's great. Like going to the doctors, a GP must feel really down because every time that someone goes in, they've got a problem. So golf's difficult. And I always say that golf's a really difficult sport, but it teaches us so much about life, doesn't it? How things aren't always going to be easy, but actually we work hard at something, we can find the answer, and golf gives us a glimmer of hope. How many times do we play the last hole well if we've had a bad round? It's just dangling the carrot, telling you to come back and give it another go. And there's so many comparisons to life. Bad breaks. One of the big things I try and say is, don't follow a bad shot with a bad decision. So if something bad happens to me in life, it's how I react to it. Don't follow it with a bad decision. Try and react in a positive way. And I think you can relate to that in life in so many ways. So golf is really hard. Golf, but you've just got to remember what it is. It's a game of golf. My golf coach, Graham Walker, you won't mind me saying this, he said, and I messaged him over something. I'd hit a bad shot in front of him. And he went, James, it's not good. It's not bad. It's golf. And I was like, that's so true, isn't it? With another friend of mine, we always say, don't let golf define you. Don't let it define you as a person that evening when you go home or you walk off the golf course. Yeah, sometimes we need 10 minutes just to remember that.
There's a guy I'm hoping to have on this podcast in the future called Steve Wheatcroft, who used to be on the PGA Tour. And he's been very open about certain challenges with alcoholism and mental health and things. He's now founded a foundation in Florida, which is to help other tour pros and people with mental health. He had Bob Rotella on his podcast recently. You're nodding, you know who Bob Rotella is. There'll be people listening or watching this, you may not know, but his name got a lot of airtime at the Masters this year because he's a psychologist working with Rory McIlroy. And I'm pretty sure this episode, I can't remember if it was recorded before or after the Masters, but it was one of the most powerful things I've heard anyone in someone like his position say, which is exactly that. He said, any golf pro or athlete I work with today, I am telling them you need, golf can't define you. You have to have a life outside of golf. And I think if you look at McIlroy now and the way he talks about his family and spending time with his daughter and he's just got a new house in England and stuff like that, like it's coming out, you know, so it's important, isn't it?
Yeah, and I have this, obviously I can walk into the pub and the first question is, have you done recently any tournaments? So it's kind of like, I sometimes feel golf defines me, and that's the question that people always ask you, like, how are you doing in your golf competitions? Instead of asking them, like, your good friends will ask you, how are you, what you've been up to kind of thing, have you done anything, you've been to the football recently?
Yeah.
But actually, people that just know me as a golf pro, it's their default to is, have you won anything recently? And I don't always like that. And
I don't blame you.
So you've got to take that on the chin, really. You try not to let golf define you.
It's quite funny that example you give as well. I can really relate to that, less in the golf context, but in I've my day job at the moment is in HR, and I've been doing that for coming up 15 years, give or take. And I worked in recruitment I came out of uni, fell into recruitment, did recruitment for quite a long time. But for the last 7 years, I've specialized in learning and development. And yet, honestly, the number of people in my family and friends group are like, oh, how's the recruitment going? I'm like, I gave that up 7 years ago. You know, it's like, don't you know that, you know, it's funny how people think of you. And And I think stuff like that has caused me to reflect on, like, yeah, my work does consume a lot of my identity. Well, you mentioned a couple of examples of playing, like, PGA Pro tournaments and things, but you played at Wentworth a few years back, did you not?
I did,
tour appearance.
Yeah, the BMW PGA Championship, but that's 12 years ago, 2013.
What was that experience like?
Yeah, really good. It was always my childhood dream to play a European tour event. So I had my best friend caddy for me, Stuart. We grew up together from when we were like 3 or 4. So that was, he's a golf pro. So that was always, when I qualified, it was I rung him and said, mate, we can sit in our rocking chair and I've done what I said I wanted to do. So when I got there to it, it was a strange one. I was shattered the time I teed off. I'd played that many practice rounds. I think I played 36 holes on a Tuesday in the practice. I was just like, I'm here at Wentworth in the BMW PGA Championship. I am going to get the most out of this. So I think I was probably a bit overwhelmed, really, with it all. I remember being on the putting green on the Monday, seeing David Howe putting, Colin Montgomery, I think Poulter was there. It was the Wentworth after they'd won the Ryder Cup at Medina, Miracle of Medina. So all the Ryder Cup players were there. Luke Donald.
It was 2011 then, I guess it would have been. 2010 was Medina, wasn't it?
No, 2012.
2012.
So this was 13.
Oh, so 2010 was Celtic Manor.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. So 2013, yeah.
So all the Ryder Cup players were there, and I'm like, standing on the putting green, and I was meant to be practicing, and I was just in awe, just looking around. So the experience was it was great. I would love to have gone, almost had the opportunity again, and I would have done things differently. I'd have gone in, practiced round, made some notes, got out of there, teed it up on Thursday, like I would do for a normal PGA event. But it was almost like milking the experience, getting new clubs to try. Like, what am I doing? Putting new wedges in my bag, different putter. Just crazy when you look back, really.
But looking back on that, why? Was it like, did you want it really badly? Or was it like to make you change your normal way of doing things?
Yeah, just trying to find the edge, really. But I suppose it's all learning, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all part and parcel of learning. I played a practice round, Nicholas Kolsarts, who played the Ryder Cup that year, the year before. So that was really cool to play with a Ryder Cup star. And he kind of went off the boil after that and then came back and he's won recently. So again, just a brilliant... It was a brilliant experience, but also... Yeah, I found the whole, when I played, I wasn't myself on the golf course. I was trying too hard, having a big crowds there. I shot something like, I think I shot 79, 77, which was okay. I found the golf course very long. It was a slog. Mm-hmm. It was a good experience, good something to be on your CV, but I probably didn't do myself justice into how you can play. But I suppose that's pressure, isn't it? It's playing under the gun. I ripped it off the first tee. I did rip it, and I dreamt of that tee shot for about 3 months before, of just hitting that tee shot and hitting it down the middle. So yeah, no, it was good.
That's brilliant. I'd love to be better in competitive golf. Like, what I do these days enjoy the most about golf is just casual social golf, because I generally play my best golf. Or probably play the best when I'm on my own and I've got no eyes in me whatsoever. But I'd really like to... I struggle in medals or comps or whatever because I want it too badly. Nerves creep in. Top tips around handling that pressure?
So I'm massive into pre-shot routines. So Bob, when you mentioned Bob Rotella, he, again, another inspiration of mine. I read all his books growing up. And pre-shot routine... That's what I would just drill into to you if you're going out in a competition. But I'd have that pre-shot routine the same if you're going out socially than you are competitively. So I hear a lot of people say, well, I can hit it on the range. I can hit it out with my mates. But on a competition, I'm wrong. I really struggle. And if you watch them, if you videoed them, they'd do something totally different.
Each of them.
Just like how long they take.
What works for them.
How long they take over the ball. How many practice swings they have. And that's, so if you asked me to write down my pre-shot routine, I could write it down and it would be the same if we were going out now for a knock or if I was playing a competition tomorrow, my routine would be the same. And I kind of evaluate that a lot. I'm kind of aware of my pre-shot routine. So for anyone that struggles with that, get a pre-shot routine that where you stand, where you put your golf, even to the things where you put your golf bag before you hit the shop. Yeah, we have a routine to get out of the house in the morning on time. We have a routine to do all things in life well, tie shoelaces, etc. You should have a routine to hit a golf shot.
So what are the components of a good pre-shot routine? What does good look like?
So good would look like not too long, because for me the long golf's hard because the ball is stationary. So if we play tennis or paddle, which is the new thing, the ball bounces and you hit it. You haven't got time to think. That's one of the things with golf. Golf is hard because the ball is stationary. It's looking up at you saying, come on then, hit me. And you go, well, I've got to do this. I've got to get my position here. I've got to do that. So the more we can make the golf swing flow, and that could be standing over the shot, put your club down, one look, back, breathe out and swing. There's a real flow to that, and you're reacting instead of standing there. And the longer you stand there, I would think you'll grip it tighter. The body tenses up and we're not thinking pretty things, are we? We're not thinking, oh, I'm going to flush this down the middle. We're thinking, don't do this, don't do that. Don't hit it in the water, don't hit it in the bunker. So the shorter, it's not about rushing, but it's about having a real flow to your routine and being aware of what a routine is.
I'd like to ask you, and moving on to remembering your sister Janine, quite early on when I launched this podcast, I really went out looking for, before I probably even thought about looking for podcast guests, like trying to find people who have been quite open and, you know, shared their stories around adversity, loss, grief, and, you know, how golf has played a role in honouring that person, remembering that person, raising awareness for causes, raising money for causes. And I came across you because there's a few PGA articles, local Nottinghamshire press articles and things. So maybe if you start by just telling Janine's story and then we...
Yeah, sure. Janine got diagnosed with cancer in 2010. And had a long battle really through till when she passed away beginning of 2018. But what I would say is in those 8 years, she crammed a lot into those 8 years. She was determined to like make a difference. And she set up something called Booby Date. So Booby Date was where she wanted everybody to set a date in their diary, whether it was their birthday or a date that was prominent to them, where they would check their breasts, men and women. Do you know what? Because men can get breast cancer as well, but to check their breasts. That was what Janine wanted to carry on. And she went on, she won the Mum Idol in The Sun. And she really tried to push. She pushed all her consultants. She would have been that annoying patient, really, that she wanted answers and she wanted to make sure she could help other people. And she met a lot of people through having breast cancer, really, the community that was there to support her as well. So that was Janine's story. And there were times where she needed to raise money for a treatment that maybe have sent to different parts of the world to try and get the best treatment possible, because it wasn't always available on the NHS. So golf became a way of running golf days. We did 100 holes of golf in 2014 to raise something like, I'm plucking numbers, but we definitely started raising over £5,000 each time we did something. Then when we ran a golf day the year before she passed away to raise some more money for some treatment at Morley Hayes. So golf, and it was amazing. I suppose the community that I'd had as a golf pro, I could fill a golf day 2-3 times over, and we were getting, I think one time we got 50 teams in a golf day from 7 o'clock in the morning through to 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. Even on the 9-hole course at Morley Hayes, were, I think it's important to say that they were always brilliant with my sort of fundraising to give the golf course up, put food on for people. So golf just gave us a platform to network, to try and raise as much money as we could, really. And then once she passed away, we carried on doing the Booby Day golf day on the 9-hole course at Morley. And then when we came out of lockdown, we were the first golf club to hit a golf ball at 1 second past midnight. I think that, well, I want to say the 29th or 30th of March 2021. And we, Morley had floodlit the golf course, and we teed off at night. And I think we had something like a billion interactions around the world with that. So that was, and that was in memory of my sister to raise money. So yeah, golf's given us so much, really, to help us with grief and things like that. My dad, who lost his life through stomach cancer as well, was a massive golfer as well. So golf's has brought people together, his friends, my friends, clients, and everything like that. So golf's been really kind to us to help us, as we were chatting earlier, to deal with grief as well.
Yeah, definitely. If you don't mind me bringing this up, James, I think, again, when we spoke a couple of weeks ago, whenever it was, in preparation for this, you were quite open with me in saying that, if I remember rightly, it was that, you know, in terms of dealing with your mental health and actually sort of, just talking about it or just kind of it's not always been that easy necessarily. So, you know, is that, looking back over these years now in terms of you managing the grief and your mental health, how that's affected it since losing your dad and then Janine, how do you manage your mental health these days?
I go in the gym a lot. That's massive for me, just to kind of have a good sweat out as well. Golf, as we were chatting earlier, golf, is when it's your job, isn't always that relaxing.
What are the tough things about it?
I think for when you're in a golf, when you're playing a golf tournament, you are on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And you're playing against two other people. You're not there to make friends. So you have a lot of time in your own head.
Yeah.
And I don't mind admitting that. When you're in your own head, it's not always a good place to be when you're dealing with that. So when golf's social and you go out and you go out with your friends, you are choosing who you've gone out with. So I can't always choose who I play a competition with. So I can see myself going more, playing more social golf over the next few years. I've pulled back from a few tournaments recently where I just thought, you know what? I don't want to go and play because I don't need to. I do enjoy, and sometimes I get paired in a tournament with some of my good friends, which is brilliant. So you're playing a competition and you're playing with your friends. And that's kind of, you're almost praying that you get drawn with a decent group. But everyone's there to try and make some money in a tournament. So there's a lot of, so we're chatting about how the importance of golf can be great for people, but also professional golfers struggle with their mental health because of the pressure that golf gives you. So that's why I go about golf not defining you. I think it's so important when you do play golf, you play golf for what you want it to be. You choose who you play golf with. And I think that's so important. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be a stressful thing that you do.
No. And I think that's where I've always recognized when I put this podcast out, you know, we're telling stories and putting a lens on health in multiple different ways in golf, but it's just a totally different pressure when you're a professional golfer. It's just not really comparable, really, to what we mere mortal amateur golfers go through. You make me think, there's a guy we had in the podcast, again, I recommend anyone to listen to it, with a guy called Ian Peake, Ian, if you know him.
I've been to a few seminars with him, yeah.
Yeah, so he, as you may know, and he studied a PhD, University of Birmingham, in recent years, and it focused on mental health on tour. For one, it was spotlighting effectively the silent struggles that a lot of these pros have for various reasons, because maybe they didn't feel like, they're not in an environment which typically talks out or about these things, but didn't feel like they had anyone to talk to. The stress of when the career's done and the money dries up, what do I do next? Sense of purpose, identity, going back to that before. One thing, though, that from that episode that he brought up in his research and his studies, found, I want to ask you which of these you are. He talked about the toughies versus the chatties. So he said, like, I don't know if it's like a Padraig Harrington is a chatty out in the course. So the way he deals with, like, maybe nerves or, you know, he'll chat away to his playing partners or whatever. But a Tiger Woods or a Patrick Reed is a toughie, like absolute poker face. Which of those are you in there?
100% chatty.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I've had people come and watch me and go, are you not focused? You're not focused. I won't talk to you. So if I ever have a caddy come with me who doesn't want to talk to me, they're not the caddy for me. Do you know what I mean? I'm there to relax. I mean, silence is horrendous, really. Do you know what I mean? Because you're in your own head again.
Yeah.
Everyone's different, and that's the joy of life, isn't it? But yeah, for golf, for me, I love a chat on the golf course. I mean, and going back to what we said about for a golf pro, it becomes stressful. I see it for too many amateur golfers that play golf that get really wound up. Really wound up. And God bless my dad. Like I say, he's not with us. He got wound up. And golf could define him at times because he just wanted to do so well. So any time I get myself into that mindset where golf means too much, that's where I've made that pact with myself now. I'll take a step back. So if I pull out of an event, it's because golf's just getting a little bit meaning too much for me. So that's my little cue now just to, I'm not playing it. I don't need to. And when I'm in the right frame of mind and I'm chilled, I'll go and play.
Yeah, fair.
So it's on. I want golf to be on my terms, and I think that golf needs to be on an amateur. That's it's a hobby. It needs to be on your terms. Yeah, if you don't want to play in a competition, you don't want to have a handicap. Don't have one. Brilliant.
Exactly.
If you want to be a member of a golf club and you want to play in the comp every Wednesday and a Saturday, and there's these rules, and you do that, well, you know what it is. Fine.
And I think part of this handicap conversation is that the beauty of the game now is like, whether it's England golf, Wales golf, these flexi schemes now where you can have a handicap. If you've got mates who are part of that as well, like you can get one and maintain it officially and formally and properly without having to play comps. Like you can go and so it's evolving, you know, the game, isn't it? So maybe final one for you is you also said something to me before about how you've mentioned in this podcast conversation already how you run overseas golf holidays. Is it Turkey, did you say?
I do a lot to Turkey, yeah. Yeah. Turkey and Spain we've gone to, and America most recently.
Nice. You've baked in some of the sort of like mental health content or conversation into some of these before. So do you want to say just a bit about how that, like what you did? How did it land? Kind of what you, things that came up, obviously, you know, without telling specific stories. I'm just really curious about that. Because these are the sorts of things that we're exploring at GYH. And
yeah, sure. No, so a couple of years ago, I used to have a sponsor for my golf holiday. So everyone gets a zip up top and the sponsor stopped that relationship. And I thought, you know what, a good opportunity would be to put a logo. And there's a woman that was at Jensen, who my youngest son's football team at the time, Joe, did a mental health brand called Semicolon Creations. So the semicolon stood for the author was going to put a pause to the story but wasn't ready to end it. So to do with suicide prevention, mental health. And I was really keen to do something with that because I think when you take a group of guys, I take a mixed trip as well, more the guys, I think, when you take them away, over a beer when they've played golf, it was a chance to chat. And I wanted them to almost say what. And so the logo was like, mental health is tough, but so are you. And it was just to try to get people to chat. Now, some people don't want to chat, which is absolutely fine. But it was almost trying to create a platform that they feel they could. So I think there's probably about 50 tops with the logo on that went out there over one winter. And my January trip, these 12 of us, we'd go away and it was fantastic. We all sat around having a beer most nights, chatting about people sort of admitting, not even admitting, but just talking about their struggles they'd had and felt comfortable to, so you could chat about your struggles and it wasn't, no one was looking down on you saying you've had a struggle. It was almost, yeah, I've had a struggle as well. And it was, yeah, for me, that really was a powerful thing.
Mm.
So again, it's having golf's given us that platform to have people around you that you feel you could open up to.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. And I can't remember if I said this to you before already, but the logo, the power of a logo, I'm a big believer in that as well. And our GYH logo, I can't remember if I told you this story, I'm not wearing it today, but there's what looks like interwoven golf tees, but it's meant to be a chromosome, which signifies the genetic disorder that my son had. You know, so he had a missing chromosome, which caused the condition that he had, that caused the heart condition that he had, whatever. And I like to think that he's showing up in the world in that way through that, you know. And it's, I like what you did there. That's really, are you done with that now? Do you think, have you sort of put that in the past, or would you try it again?
Yeah, I would. And done in the right way. So I'm all for trying to get people to talk. And I think the more I do that, it makes me talk, because I can tell everyone else to chat about stuff, and I probably can be a bit of a closed book as well, which is not always a good thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, no, I would be really open to it. And again, using golf as a platform to spread the word of certain things. I think whether that's mental health, certain charities, I'm in a position to help. And I think it's important that I do that. Other PGA pros do that. Golf clubs do that as well, because we're in a world that can be quite selfish. And actually trying to spread the word of things, I think is, and I've got a lot of good people around me that I've met in the last few years through golf as well, not just from around here, from London as well, mm-hmm. that are always keen to get involved as well. So yeah, golf's brilliant. So just don't let it define you.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you like what you've heard today and want to hear more content like this, then please head over to golfyourselfhealthy.com and subscribe now. Until our next episode, always remember to embrace the rough and forever cherish the fairway.